Live from Utrecht, this is Bitcoin
Explained.
Hello, Sjors.
What's up?
Welcome back.
Thank you.
You've been back for... Do you even live in this country still?
I certainly do, yes.
You were gone for like 2 months?
No, have one, you been? 1 month.
1 month, a couple of conferences. Where did you go?
Too many conferences, in fact. Bitcoin Indonesia, Nostrasia in Tokyo.
Well, but the thing is, before that, you were in the States for a while and you were in Portugal.
I was, but I was home for a few weeks in between.
All right. Well, you were gone for so long that there's a new Bitcoin Core release.
That's right.
Bitcoin Core 26. But before we get into... So that's what this episode is going to be about. Sure, we're going to discuss Bitcoin Core 26.
Cool.
But there's been some recent developments that you suggested we briefly touch on before we get there.
Yeah, I think so. So remember, dear listeners, if you listen to episode 37 back in 2021, we talked about Marapool, which at the time was making blocks that they said were OFAC compliant. As far as we know, they did not actually do any filtering. But this triggered a developer, which we will call 0xb10c,
mm-hmm.
To write a tool that monitors the blockchain for set censorship, just in case that would ever happen.
Yeah, so just to reiterate what this all means, there is an OFAC list, and this means there are entities on there that you're not allowed to transact with, and that's the U.S. government sanctioned list. Is that the right way to think about
yes,
it?
Yes, correct.
So these would include people that the U.S. government does not like, essentially.
Yes, these are only people that the U.S. government does not like.
Right, and there are Bitcoin addresses on this list?
Yeah, so I think the general idea is that they say, hey, this guy and this guy, you should not do business with them, and this is how you recognize them, and they'll spell out their name in like 5 different ways, and give maybe some known addresses, and they might also give some known Bitcoin addresses that are associated with this person.
Right, so there are Bitcoin addresses on this list, and if you want to send Bitcoin to or from these addresses... Then, so what Marathon Pool was doing was they would essentially filter these transactions out, not include these transactions into a block. That's how they would comply with this list, right?
Yeah, but they didn't actually do that. I think they were thinking about doing that. And they put some operatory message in the block. But we explained that back in that episode, because as far as I know, they didn't actually do any filtering,
mm-hmm.
but it caused quite a lot of consternations, and they backed out of that idea. I think they even replaced their CEO, though that may have been completely unrelated.
Hmm.
But anyway, it was enough motivation for him to write this tool. And what this tool does is it basically runs a Bitcoin Core full node, and a Bitcoin Core full node will propose a block. Basically, it just every 10 seconds creates what it thinks would be a correct block. It doesn't do the proof of work. It just constructs the block. And then when a real block appears, it compares it. So it looks at which transactions are missing that were expected to be in the block and which transactions are not missing.
Mm-hmm.
And then for the transactions that are missing, it would run it against a bunch of heuristics of why it might be missing. Usually it's completely innocent. So for example, a transaction might be very new. Maybe your node has heard about it 1 second ago. Then it's very likely that other nodes have not heard about it yet. So it's not surprising that it's not in a block. Something else that tends to happen, especially these days, is that miners will have an accelerator service where they will prioritize transactions that, if you look at their Bitcoin fees, they should not be in the block, but they are in the block because they've paid through credit card or some other way to be included in the block. And so basically some of the tools automatically filter some of these things, and other times he basically wrote a blog post about it, doing it manually, just checking out what's going on here.
Okay, so what is going on here? Why are we discussing this?
Well, what seems to be going on here is that there are 4 transactions by F2 Pool, which...
Transactions by F2 Pool?
Well, transactions not by F2 Pool.
Transactions not included in a block by F2 Pool.
Exactly.
Right.
4 of them. And if you look at each 4 of them, I believe 2 or 3 of those, there's not a good explanation of why they're not in a block. Could still be innocuous, but they're not recent transactions. They're not pushed out because other transactions were prioritized, etc. And then the explanation that would remain is that they were filtered because they were on that list.
So they are on that list.
They definitely are on that list. Right. Yeah, that's not the problem.
Okay, got it. So censorship is upon us.
Well, yes, but we didn't know for sure. Mm-hmm. I guess we could just do the analysis. But then there was a tweet by, I guess, the person in control of F2 Pool. And
Wang Jun?
Yes. Who says, we'll disable the TX filtering patch for now until the community reaches a more comprehensive consensus on this topic. So basically...
So that is a confirmation that he was, in fact, filtering out OFAC transactions in breach of the OFAC list.
Yes, or at least some of them, because it's not clear if he was filtering all of them.
Mm-hmm. But where does this patch even come from? Like, is this a patch?
Presumably can I download this patch?
Okay.
No, you'd have to write it yourself. You'd have to do something like, if this transaction arrives...
Bitcoin Core does not offer this patch.
No. Okay. But I guess you can write a patch that keeps things from going into your mempool. I don't know if we have a way to get things out of your mempool once it's in there.
Anyways, so Wang Chun F2 Pool was using a patch, maybe self-written, maybe not, to filter these blocks out. No, these transactions out of blocks.
Yes.
To comply with the OFAC list. And now he's...
Well, we don't know if it was to comply with the OFAC
list.
Why
are you hedging everything so much? It's pretty obvious at this point, right? You did the analysis.
No, because there are some unconfirmed tweets that suggest that...
And he confirmed it on Twitter.
Yeah, but there are some other unconfirmed screenshots of tweets that suggest that motive may have been slightly different. But in any case, we know that these transactions were deliberately filtered.
But what's the alternative motivation?
Well, it might be that he just doesn't like those particular people.
He just doesn't like the same people that the US government doesn't like.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, but then still he's filtering transactions.
Yes.
Like there's still some form of censorship happening, right?
Exactly. But there could be two different reasons for censorship, right? One is you're afraid of some government, like the US government, making your life difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And the other could be, well, you think the US government is actually right.
Okay.
But we have no idea which of those two is the true motivation. I'm just saying either is possible.
Sure. Should we?
Either is problematic.
Are we talking about this because we should be worried about this? Is your opinion that we should be worried about this?
I think we talked about that in the earlier episode, that I am worried about this in the long run. Now, in the short run, it's absolutely not a problem because these transactions were just mined by another miner, the next block.
Yeah.
Ironically, by a US miner.
Yeah. Maybe it's a bit much to go over this whole thing again. Again, we discussed it in episode 37, you said?
Yes.
Yeah, so that's where we discuss, I guess, in depth how worried we are about it anyways. Short term, so now it's turned off. I guess the other thing maybe worth mentioning is, so this is something that...
So the fact that we were able to detect this at all is because, you know, of all this tooling, it's not that obvious normally because transactions, you know, sometimes they appear in a block, sometimes they don't. So that's pretty cool that we have detected.
Yeah, well,
but the impact
another,
is pretty minor.
Another relevant episode, perhaps, to listen to in this context is the episode we did on Stratum V2, because Stratum V2 is kind of a solution for this problem, if we consider it a problem, right?
Yeah, what Stratum V2 does that's relevant here is that it delegates the responsibility of putting things into a block, not to the mining pool, which tends to be quite large. You know, there's two pools that are 51% roughly of all the hash power, but it delegates it to individual miners. So, and that's far more of them.
Yeah, so we discussed that in episode 80. Okay, this was a long intro. I guess the reason this is worth bringing up is because, I mean, it seems this is kind of the thing that Bitcoin developers and journalists maybe as well sometimes have been like talking about and warning about for many years. And this is sort of the first time it's actually happening. So there's actually...
Yeah, and also if you go through, you know, this, if you just assume a slippery slope, which is always a problematic type of argument, but if you do, then the ultimate outcome of this is you're back to PayPal because all transactions have to be KYC'd and permissioned before they go into a block. Now, we're nowhere near that, but does this make sense to worry about this?
Right. It is sort of a first step in that direction, and it's interesting to see how things will play out, I guess. So the first step mm-hmm. we now saw is that Wang Jun disabled his patch. But it's an event in that sense. Like it's a beginning of something that could go in a very wrong direction, even though it's only a very small step right now.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Are we done with this?
This was
the intro to our Bitcoin Core 26th episode. Okay, let's talk about Bitcoin Core 26 then.
Yes.
First of all, I think everyone knows this by now. Actually, I'm not even going to ask you about this anymore. I'll just preface this. So the way it works, Bitcoin Core releases a new version of the software every 6 months. And that means that every new feature that was done within these 6 months is in Bitcoin Core. And that's a new release. There is not a new release because there is a new feature. There's just a new release, and whatever is new is new.
That's right. Yes, exactly. So yeah. So there are no like things that must be finished before the deadline. Whatever is ready is ready.
Right. So the last release was about half a year ago, apparently, right?
Mm-hmm.
At this point, where are we in the release process?
There have been two release candidates.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I know, the second candidate does not have many problems. So maybe it's the last one. Maybe there'll be another one.
Right. We'll so potentially the new Bitcoin Core release could be announced, released any day now.
Exactly.
Okay.
Or maybe a few weeks. What's interesting, perhaps, is that there is a testing guide. Now, every release, there is always a testing guide, but this one apparently has had some extra love and attention. So if you've ever wanted to test a release, you should look for the... I think if you Google Bitcoin Core 26 release testing guide, you'll find it, and hopefully it'll be in our show notes.
Who is this for? This is for developers, I would assume.
I would say a little bit lower barrier to entry than being a developer. Anybody who can download a piece of software and carefully follow up instructions.
So what are you testing?
You're testing things that have changed. So there's all the features that we're talking about, but there's also lots of smaller changes, and the testing guide will basically take you through some of the changes and how you might go about testing them. Of course, you should also test things in a way that's not in the guide.
How would you go about testing them? Like what can you give an example of what we're talking about here?
Yeah, well, I guess we can do that when we cover the actual changes.
Okay, sure. Do you want to get into the actual changes?
Sure.
Okay, so the actual change. So what we did, well, mostly short, to be honest, is you picked out a couple of features in this new release that are noteworthy.
Mm-hmm.
Even more, like you picked out the most noteworthy of the most noteworthy changes, right?
I just picked the ones that I thought were cool.
Okay, so the first one, oh yeah, and we mentioned some of them in our previous episode, actually, because in the previous episode, which I guess by now is 2 months ago, we did mention some new inclusions in Bitcoin Core, or you did already. So we'll sort of repeat these for whoever missed that episode, or just to give a complete picture. So the first one is peer-to-peer transport encryption.
That's right.
What's the BIP number for that again? Do you remember? Do you know?
No.
It's not BIP 151, right? That one was replaced.
No, it's a new one. Yeah. Just it's peer-to-peer encryption. So we did a whole episode on this, episode 77, that really explains why you want to do this. But the short version is that nodes will encrypt their traffic between each other so that especially internet providers cannot simply just listen to what you're doing. This is actually very easy to test. It's also something that's not on by default, but as part of testing, you might want to turn that on. So roughly the way you would test is you download Bitcoin Core, the new version. You turn this feature on by changing the configuration setting. And then your friend also downloads Bitcoin Core, also turns this feature on. And now you try to connect to them. So in Bitcoin Core, normally it automatically finds peers, but you can manually say, hey, please connect to this IP address. And then you can actually get something called a session ID. It should be in the instructions, but basically you'll be able to see a number just like with Signal, a long number. And if you compare that long number with what your friend sees as a long number, then you know that you are directly connected to them. There's not a man in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of thing you can test. And it'd be very worrying if the number was different. That would indicate a bug.
Right.
Or somebody spying on you, but probably a bug.
Okay, well, let's linger here a little bit, because now you spoke about testing, and we did discuss it in previous episodes, but still. So right now, Bitcoin Core nodes, they're part of the peer-to-peer network, so they communicate with each other, which specifically means they send transactions and blocks to each other. And right now, they do that over an unencrypted channel. It's just plain text. It's just plain information, right? So that means that internet service providers can see exactly which transactions and blocks you're sending. And I guess the main problem is that this would allow ISPs to sort of see where transactions originate. Is that the main problem?
Yeah, I'd say that's one problem.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is it makes censorship easier, because if it's very easy to detect that it's a Bitcoin node, it's also very easy to block it. Now, that's still easy with this encryption in place for other reasons, but having encryption, it makes it one step easier to get around censorship.
Okay. That's basically it, right? That mm-hmm. covers this. Okay, so this is now in Bitcoin Core, but it's optional?
Yes.
So you can switch it on. And is there preferential, or did you just explain it? Is there preferential seeking of other nodes that do the same thing?
Yes. Or? No, it's not preferential. But if it happens to connect to another node and it knows that it has this feature, it will use it. But it's not preferential.
Okay, so it still connects to other nodes randomly, but they will first sort of try, hey, are you using encryption?
Because no, I only they will only encryption. Try if they think the other side can use it.
Oh, so how do that? So how would my node think that your node is using encryption?
So we talked about, I think in episode 2 or 3, we talked about how nodes bootstrap and learn about other nodes. So they learn about nodes by having a list of IP addresses to connect to. But in addition to those IP addresses, there's also some metadata of which features these nodes support. So in your long address book of potential nodes to connect to is information like, is this a prune node or a full node? Does it have specific Bloom filters or whatever filters you want? And as of now, it also tracks whether the node supports V2 transport. Hmm. So if your address book says that this other node supports that new feature, which could be a lie, but at least that information would be there, then it'll try that first. And if it fails, just tries the V1 connection. Now, right. I guess in the future, we might turn that around and just always try the V2 and then fall back to V1 if it doesn't work.
Yeah, why wouldn't she just always try it? Just because it's extra data to communicate? Like this extra try? Like, why wouldn't she just by default first try encrypted?
Because if you first try encrypted and the other side does not support it, the other side will hang up on you. So you have to connect again, which is not the end of the world. But right now, the majority of the network doesn't support it. So that means all of your connections would fail and you'd retry.
I see.
But I don't know if that's a big enough deal in the long run. So it might be turned around. Just try it.
Yeah, I would assume eventually the goal is that everyone would use this, right? Are there any downsides to using this?
Well, there is now because it's too new. So if something goes wrong, your node might simply fail to connect or get hung up on by all of its peers and you don't get the latest blocks, right? So right now it's not safe yet. But in the long run, I don't think there's any downside. It was designed to not have downsides in the sense that it's actually even a little bit faster than the original protocol.
Hmm.
You'd think it'd be slower because it's encrypted, but the original protocol uses checksums to make sure that the messages are correct. And those checksums use SHA-256, which is very slow. And the new algorithm uses a quicker checksum. So it's better in hopefully in every way if it's not broken.
Right. So how if I download Bitcoin Core 26, how do I switch this on?
You go into your bitcoin.conf settings file,
mm-hmm.
and then you turn on, I think you enter V2 transport equals 1. But okay. It'll be in there, either the release notes or the testing guide.
Right. All right. Moving on to the next point. Assume UTXO was implemented for Cygnet, testnet, not mainnet, right?
That's right.
Okay, so what is assume UTXO again?
Well, we covered that in episode 14. So that's quite a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically the short version of it is that instead of starting at the genesis block when you start your node and going all the way to the most recent block, which takes a long time, you start at a snapshot and you assume that it's valid. And then you go from the snapshot, which might be a few months ago, to the present, to the tip. And then once you've done that, you start from the genesis block and in the background, you check all the blocks and you make sure that you indeed arrive at this snapshot that you assumed initially.
So the benefit here would be that you can start using the Bitcoin Core node before fully syncing?
Yes. You would basically sync only the last 10% of the blockchain and you would be immediately able to use a wallet, receive coins, send coins. But there's still some chance that your starting point was wrong. And what could go wrong then is, let's say there's some malicious developers and they just create fake coins. Well, now you think you've received coins, but these coins don't actually exist. Now that's a really, really expensive attack, right? Because somebody still has to make a block with enough proof of work
mm-hmm.
that is wrong according to all the other nodes,
mm-hmm.
but only correct according to you or the list of victims that they have. So I don't think that attack is super realistic, but we still want
to... Plus the developers need to be corrupt, obviously.
Like, yeah, so this depends on the distribution mechanism. Right now, the idea is that the correct block is hard-coded into the source code, so you would indeed have to compromise the developers. You could, we could still change that approach. I don't know if it'll be changed. But the approach could be that, no, you can just use any block, and the developers do not bless any of the blocks. Because it's the downside of the developers blessing the blocks is that, well, now if you compromise the developers, you're screwed.
How would you use any block?
You basically, Bitcoin Core wouldn't care. Like, you would just give it a block, say, assume this one is correct.
Mm-hmm.
You just download that from somebody on the internet that you trust.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll find out if it was right or not, but it'll take a while.
Right, I see. And obviously, so...
So that means there's no centralized group of people to pressure or to corrupt.
Yep.
But the downside is you will get scammed left and right because everybody can just make their own fake one.
Yeah. Okay, interesting. So wait, which version is implemented in Bitcoin Core right now?
The blessed one.
Okay, the developers have blessed it.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, you mentioned...
And for testnet and signet, obviously that's fine.
Right.
But it's also not, there's also no theft risk there.
Right. It's only on testnet now and signet, mm-hmm. which is a version of testnet. So you mentioned even if it would be on mainnet, the attack would be expensive because you need to create a fake block and you need to, at least in the current version, corrupt the developers. Plus it would only work temporarily because it's kind of a stopgap until you've actually synced from...
Yeah, basically, once you've seen from the Genesis block, the node would crash.
It's kind of it's sort of a solution until in the meantime.
Yeah,
and therefore it's obviously also optional. You can just opt to actually wait until it's fully synced before you receive any transaction.
Although in that case, you should just not use the feature.
Yes, well, that's what I'm saying. The feature is basically optional.
That's true in general. Yes. So if you wanted to test this again, you download Bitcoin Core, then you obtain the Signet or the Testnet snapshot. There's some links to torrents, I believe. And then you just run one command and you'll see it in action.
Okay, so that's also new in Bitcoin Core 26. On to the third point. The third hand-picked selection by Shors is network diversity. There's a new upgrade in updated network diversity tools. What's going on, Shors?
Yeah, so I believe if I understand this feature correctly, and I did not read it up in detail, it's been a while, but here's the thing. Bitcoin Core will connect to about 8 nodes, will make connections outbound to about 8 nodes.
That's the default? 8 is the default?
Yes, mm-hmm. might be 9 now. But and then other nodes might connect to you, but if you're behind a router, etc., then that won't happen. Now, those 8 nodes, by default, would just be on plain internet, IPv4, IPv6. But if you want to, you can also connect to Tor nodes
mm-hmm.
if you turn Tor on. Now, if you don't do anything, you may or may not have a connection to a Tor node. And if you have one and you lose that connection because they hang up on you or something goes wrong, then you're just going to connect to a new node and maybe it's a Tor node, maybe not.
Wait, if I'm using Bitcoin Core, which I am, but I haven't explicitly made any sort of change to connect through Tor. Can I still connect to other Tor nodes? No, right?
No, you have to turn something on to do that.
Okay, got it. Okay, go on.
But once you have turned it on, mm-hmm. and you let the Bitcoin Core node automatically handle what it connects to, you may or may not have a connection to another Tor node. And if you have a connection to another Tor node and you hang up on that one or they hang up on you, maybe you won't have it again.
Right. So what you're saying is I'm connected to 8 nodes. One of them is a Tor node because I switched the thing on that allows me to connect to Tor nodes. Now, this guy's internet, Wi-Fi fails, whatever. I'm disconnected with him. So now I'm going to reconnect randomly to another node, which may or may not be a Tor node. So it's possible that I'm connecting to not a Tor node, and now I'm not connecting to any Tor node, right?
Yeah, so basically the Tor feature so far just does not guarantee that you actually connect to a Tor node.
Right.
You may or may not.
Yep.
And so this new change makes sure that you do.
Right.
It makes sure that at least, I don't know what the percentage is, but let's say at least one connection will go to Tor if you have Tor on. And it will basically, if that connection disappears, it'll make another one.
And so the way I would do this, again, is I go into the config file and
No, this just works.
This just works. Out of the box.
If you have Tor on, yes, this just works. Tor does not work out of the box.
Sure. Okay, so this will basically guarantee that I'm going to connect to a Tor node if I want that.
Well, assuming there is one that you can connect to at all, but it will try, yeah.
Yeah.
And now
what's the benefit?
This solves a problem known as Eclipse attacks, and we have done previous episodes too about Eclipse attacks.
Also probably very early on, I think.
Yes, I forgot to write down the numbers, but you'll find them. Basically, in Eclipse Attack, the idea is that some evil person makes sure that your node only connects to them. So you think you're connected to 8 different peers, but you're not. You're connected to the same person because they have 8 different IP addresses and tricked you into connecting to them. I'll explain all that. Now, if you also connect through Tor, this attack becomes more difficult because they might be able to trick you into connecting to them through normal IP addresses, but they may not be able to trick you into connecting to them through Tor. Or if they're making the connections to you, they might not know your onion address that they're connecting to. They only know your normal IP address.
Yeah.
So that's why this helps.
That's kind of a safeguard. Like Eclipse attacks themselves are kind of unlikely to happen. There are more tools against that, right, in Bitcoin Core?
Yeah, I would also say Eclipse attacks, you know, again, in order, Eclipse attacks are getting more and more difficult. And if you want to do them, you probably want to have a motive, like you want to be able to scam somebody into accepting your payment and then double spending them and working with miners and all that stuff. They're not easy attacks, but we like to make them impossible or harder.
So Tor is kind of a lifeline to still get the latest blocks in case they're being censored as some sort of Eclipse attack scheme. Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, so this is more difficult. So this is also new in Bitcoin Core. The network diversity is embedded more thoroughly. Then I'm seeing you selected, there's a Taproot miniscript upgrade.
Yeah, so we covered miniscript in episode 4, so a very long time ago.
Really?
Yep. One of the first things we did. So what's the TLDR of miniscript? It is a subset of script, you could say. So not all of Bitcoin script, but a part of Bitcoin script that has been handpicked by super wizards like Andrew Polstra and SIPA to make sure that you don't shoot yourself in the foot.
Yeah.
And that you can combine pieces of script, like 2 pieces of script, and you put and in between it, etc.
Yeah.
So these allow you to do complicated fancy wallets with like, okay, I want 2 signatures, but after 1 year, I only want 1 signature, etc. And this worked. This has been added to Bitcoin Core a year ago or so in various steps, which we've covered in earlier episodes. And the latest step is that you can now also use Miniscript with Taproot.
Right. And what is the benefit?
So the benefit of Taproot in general...
Maybe should I first, for those that didn't follow that, so yeah, Bitcoin transactions use scripts, so it's basically programming language for Bitcoin, allows you to lock Bitcoins up in all sorts of creative ways, time locks, multi-sig, whatever, and Miniscript is a way to sort of simplify that, and it's really for developers, right? Like, I'm not going to use it, it's for people like you, and...
It's for developers like or for wallets that have been written by very small developers and that do it for you in the background.
Right. But with regular script, it's kind of easy to make mistakes and lose coins. And with mini scripts, kind of the most common ways to make these mistakes are just ejected. Like you can't use this. Only the simple stuff is left. And because of that, you can actually make fairly complex things relatively simply and safely.
Yeah.
Okay. So this was already available in Bitcoin Core. So what this means specifically is I think you can connect wallets that use this to Bitcoin Core. And I don't think I'm saying that right. Can
well,
you
that's,
say that
that's
right?
True. Yeah. So, the Bitcoin Core wallet supports Miniscript.
Right.
But there's no like graphical way or anything in the interface where you can do that. You'd have to manually type these pieces of Miniscript. But there are wallets out there that will connect to Bitcoin Core using the RBC, for example, and they might use the Bitcoin Core wallet for the key storage, etc. But they would have some graphical user interface and they would construct the Miniscript.
So where, I think I'm skipping ahead when
so
I
where
ask this
Taproot
question.
Comes in, I think.
No, I don't want to go there yet. Okay. Where is this? I don't know how else to ask it. Is this in the Bitcoin Core wallet or is this in the Bitcoin Core like node software? So where do I find whatever we're talking about?
Well, the Miniscript lives in the Bitcoin Core wallet.
Yes. So we're talking about the Taproot upgrade. Let's go there then.
Yeah.
So now this has been made available in Taproot. So is this an upgrade in the Bitcoin Core wallet?
Yes.
Okay, got it. So what's the upgrade?
So the upgrade is that you can now use this Miniscript, so these safe pieces of script, not just in SegWit, in regular SegWit, which used to be the only thing, but you can now also use it in Taproot scripts. And remember, what's nice about Taproot scripts is you can have all these multiple ways that you can spend a coin. you can now hide all the ways that you're not using by putting them in different leaves. So right. your wallet would basically know that, okay, there are five different subscripts, essentially, that are possible, and the user will tell me which one of these five to use when I want to spend this coin, and will hide the other ones. And there were some, like, there's some subtle changes between the scripts in Taproot and the scripts in SegWit before. Some limits were dropped, but that's not that important.
Right. It's just, I mean, it's basically just the benefits of Taproot are now available in combination with Miniscript in the Bitcoin Core wallet.
Yes, but either you will have to write your little Taproot Miniscript yourself and put it in the wallet. Once you've put it in the wallet, by the way, it just works, right? You just click on receive new, make new address. It'll show an address, looks like any other address. And you'll be able to spend from it, and it'll just work.
Mm-hmm.
But you generally do not want to type Miniscript yourself, even though it's safer than regular script. You probably want to use some other tool that does that for you.
Right. So this is available in Bitcoin Core now, Bitcoin Core 26. Well, I say now, at the time of recording, we're still in.
Yeah, I don't know if this is in the testing guide. Maybe it is. That would be pretty cool.
Who's going to benefit from this? What, are there any wallets that use this right now or that want to use this?
I think Liana Wallet wants to, because they're trying all sorts of fancy multi-sig, multi-stage, multi-sig things, right?
What's it called?
Multi-sig.
No, the wallet.
Liana.
Liana. Yeah. Have I heard of this? I don't think so.
Wizard Sardine is the company.
Oh, yeah. Okay, Kevin.
Yeah, and they do a lot of work on Miniscript in general too, to contribute back.
Yep. That's true.
But hopefully, and I know, for example, that there's other wallets that support Miniscript already, but the hard part is the setup part, I would say. So many wallets might be able to sign Miniscript, even hardware wallets, but they will not, once you've put it in there, but it's not that easy to make these wallets in the first place.
Right.
All right.
Okay. Last point, I think. We're going to the last point. The last mentionable upgrade in Bitcoin Core 26. Submit package RPC, you wrote down.
Yeah, I believe in previous episodes we have talked about the idea of package relay for transactions. So then the simplest example is I have a Lightning channel. I want to force close that Lightning channel. My partner of the Lightning channel, or no longer partner of the Lightning channel, is offline. So all I have is the last time we co-signed a transaction, and this was before ordinals were invented, and fees were super low. And so I try to broadcast that transaction, but it simply does not even go into the mempool of my peers.
We have a solution for that, though. You can use child pays for parent shorts.
That's right. The only problem is the
solution, hang on, let me explain the solution. So the solution is I'm going to spend the money from this transaction to myself with a higher fee. So now the miner will see that if he wants to confirm the high fee transaction, he'll also have to confirm the low fee transaction, and I'll get the money, and the problem is solved, right?
Correct, yes. And the miners already do this, as far as I know. The problem is getting it to the miner, because this is where the bureaucrats come in. You basically go to your peers in the network, and you say, here's the transaction, but hold on one second, I've got another transaction. But no. Your peer will say, no, this transaction is too low of a fee. But wait, I have this other transaction. Here's the other transaction. Well, that has a really high fee, thank you, but it's spending a transaction that I've never heard about.
Yeah, hang on. You got to emphasize. So when they say this has not enough fee, the fee is too low, what they even mean is the fee is too low for the mempool. Yes. They're not even going to include it in the mempool.
Yes.
So yes, it would not fit in the block. Now, that's fine because it usually goes into the mempool and then you can use the child pays for parent trick that I explained.
Yeah.
But in this case, the transaction, because of all these ordinals, isn't even going to fit into the mempool, and therefore it's not going to be seen by anyone, and therefore the higher fee transaction is not going to be seen by anyone either, because it's not spending funds from a transaction that anyone is seeing.
Yeah, because mempools only process transactions one by one, and if the first one doesn't pay enough fee, it's not going in there.
Right.
So what is the solution? It is you need a way to send two transactions at the same time to your peers.
Yeah, so peers and miners will consider them in tandem right from the get-go, before it even goes in the mempool, essentially.
Yeah, and this thing is called package relay, and work is in progress to do that. It's not easy, and we've discussed some baby steps in that direction. One of the first baby steps was the RPC called submit package. And the idea was to send transactions to your own mempool. So not to your peers, just to your own mempool. And I think half a year ago or so, we covered how that worked. You would give this RPC two transactions and it would just basically reject it because it would use the same logic as always. It would process them one by one. So why was that added? Well, because the next step makes it more useful. Now with the 26.0 release, it will actually consider both of them and therefore include it in its own mempool.
Right.
But not relay it.
So this upgrade only applies to... If I make two transactions with one of them is a low fee, one of them is a high fee, I can now send this transaction over RPC to my own node. Mm-hmm. But that's it, right?
Yeah, and you could imagine maybe there would be a website of a miner where you can send it directly to the miner this way and they would use their own RPC.
Right.
That's not the future, obviously, but you could see some use even of this primitive feature.
Right. So there's now something in Bitcoin Core. It's a baby step. It's a step towards packet relay, right?
Exactly.
That's just the way to think about it.
Yeah.
It's actually kind of useless in itself. Or is there, you just speculated about a potential maybe use case of a miner? Yeah, and the other is like,
at least it would be in your mempool. And so maybe once the fees go down, you know, it's a bit easier to
rebroadcast it or something. Yeah,
but rebroadcasting is also not automatic. So yeah, no, it's not there yet.
It's basically useless. But it is a step towards packet relay, which itself is a useful and important upgrade one day, hopefully, right?
Yes.
Okay, great. So these are, we now discussed five of the most important upgrades in Bitcoin Core. That's the episode, actually, right?
That's right. That's a wrap.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to Bitcoin
Explained.